Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates, and it is a good day here at Worldwide KFUO. We've got some fun lined up for today, something special. Got a special guest lined up, and we're going to talk with the Reverend Kevin Parviz, also known as Rev Kev, right?
Yeah.
Joining me in studio today, Reverend Kevin Parviz from Congregation Kiv Shalom, and also Burning Bush Ministries here in St. Louis. We're going to talk about Jewish family traditions and how they point to Yeshua here in just a little bit. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting the program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, you can go to our website, kfuo.org, and look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. Click on that. That'll take you to their page, and you can find out all about all they have to offer, the programs, where they're located, including right here in St. Louis. Go check it out, kfuo.org. Well, it's a fun day. We even get to break the rules a little bit today.
I see that.
Yeah, we don't usually get to have food in the studio here. We got to keep things clean. So don't tell our engineer that I have.
I noticed there on the screen, you know, you're going to get killed, it says.
I brought some inspiration for our conversation today. Pastor Parviz, now, do they call you Rev Kevya at your congregation? I love your email address,
yeah,
Rev
Kevya. Yeah, they call all kinds of things, but Rev Kevya is the name I generally go by. It's obviously it's an homage to Fiddler on the Roof. So,
absolutely. Yeah. You know that there's a theater group producing that here in the St. Louis area in the near future. I think Stages has it in their lineup this year. So, well, tell us about your background. Tell us about your history. I've read a little bit about it, but tell us your story.
Well, I grew up in an observant Jewish home in Denver, and our congregation, our synagogue, closed at some point after I bar mitzvahed, and couldn't really afford to move to the West Side. And so little by little, from observancy to sort of reform, I made that transition over my time. By the time I got to college, though, I was pretty much your average pretentious college kid who was a logical determinist, and whatever that means. And but in college, I met a young woman who was a Missouri Synod Lutheran, and as I always give this caveat, I don't support missionary dating. It generally does not work out very well, but and God does not want you to be unequally yoked. But for whatever reason, long story short, we got married, started having children, moved back to Denver. My wife started going back to church, started taking our kids to church. I was, of course, vehemently against any of that. In fact, I kind of made her life probably a little miserable in those early years, I'm sure. But over time, my kids started witnessing to me, especially my oldest. She started when she was about 3. And then the kids in her school, she went to the Lutheran day school there in Denver at St. John's. And just little by little, those kids, my wife, I had given her the, you know, the caveat, you want to go back to church, that's fine, never bring it home to me. And so she honored that, but she didn't allow our kids to. So those kids just kind of led me into the kingdom. And that community of faith at St. John's was very loving and very understanding. Pastor David Cook, now sainted, was he was a saint then too, let me tell you. But he, all these cameras in here, those are new. What's the deal with this?
We're hoping in the future to be able to live stream.
Okay.
Some video for special occasions, yeah. Like today.
Yeah, sure. With all this tchotchkes you got here. But one day, quit fighting it, I think, because I spent most of my life, because I had been witness to before, it's not like I was living in a vacuum and people hadn't shared their faith with me, but it was always in ways that I thought were really offensive. And my heart was just really hard to the name of Jesus. And I, little by little over time, I think the Holy Spirit just kind of softened my heart where I could actually talk about it without getting angry. And and then I just gave up, you know, so...
As a Jew, what was offensive that when people would talk about Jesus or witness to Jesus?
Well, I mean, my earliest recollection of a friend of mine who tried to witness to me as only he thought he could, and this was, of course, probably 4th or 5th grade, but he went to a Catholic school. He was my next door neighbor, And his nickname, I mean, he started out with calling me Christ Killer, and little by little it came down to CK. I was CK before Calvin Klein, I always say. And you know, that was just his way. His priest told him that the Jews killed Jesus, and so I'm Jewish, so I'm a Christ Killer. He pointed this crucifix. And, you know, that's, you know, after you start by arguing, and after a while you just give up and say, oh, dummy. And it was things like that. I actually... I was argumentative, and I didn't mind going toe-to-toe with people. I would make people mad. I feel so bad about this. I don't know who this woman was, but I remember making this little Baptist lady so mad at me, she actually hit me with her Bible. And, you know, that kind of stuff. And it just... things like that.
It still didn't work at that time.
Yeah, huh? Right. Beating you over the head with the Bible doesn't work. But... and it's just people, I think people, you know, they try to witness their faith in as much sincerity as they can muster, but I don't think they, you know, I think it's necessary to really kind of understand the cultural context people come from. You can't preach from an ivory tower and expect people to look up and listen. You got to get down in the dirt with them. And it wasn't really until Pastor Cook. My kids. I mean, it's hard to look your kids in the eye and say, no, I hate your Jesus. But Pastor Cook, he was willing to get down in the dirt with me and really talk the talk, you know, and walk the walk. That was really kind of the first... my first exposure to a church that, you know, made sense to me.
Now, when you married your wife, did you still observe Jewish traditions and customs?
You know, not really. I had pretty much walked away from all that. You know, first of all, I had married a shiksa, so, you know, my life as a Jewish boy was pretty much over as far as that was concerned. You can't marry. And we kind of, both my wife and I were sort of estranged from our families. We got married by a Unitarian in a Holiday Inn. So, you know, that's kind of how
now
that
Now, there's
went.
A story.
Yeah, that was an interesting story. My wife actually wanted to reinstill, she wanted to teach our kids some of my traditions because she wanted to do a Passover Seder one year. And I had just kind of given that up. I just, you know, I remembered them from when I was a kid and all of that, but I just wasn't all that interested. She was the one that instigated that, and I think, you know, in some way it was kind of her way of bringing it home to me in a way that she felt I could. And so we started having Passover Seders at home, and she started learning how to cook Jewish, which was interesting. And our kids, you know, little by little over time, I kind of adopted it until I came to faith. Then I became so assimilated in the Lutheran Church, I never thought I'd go back. And then God called me into this ministry, and my kids have all grown up better Jews than I am, so because they know Jesus, and that's the most Jewish thing you can do. It's been an interesting experience. You know, all my regret in marrying a shiksa was that I was leaving my people behind, but, you know, frankly, I loved her enough to do that. And I was leaving my traditions behind, and then God caught up with me and said, you don't have to. And I think that's the message that we have to really, not only are we as Christians, you know, Paul talks about us as Christians being grafted into the tree of Abraham and receiving by adoption all the blessings of Abraham, you know, all the blessings of the Hebrew Scriptures, even the blessings of the traditions that we have. And in celebrating those and looking forward and seeing the fulfillment of Jesus, that's a great blessing. But for Jewish people, it is important to find these bridges over which the gospel can travel. And these bridges have to be in their cultural context, as with any cultural context. You know, I think we always think of the term of missionaries, you know, the great white missionary going to deep, dark Africa and forcing Africans to become Christians kind of thing. That's not how it works. And you know, obviously we have the African church is exploding now because people are living there and connecting with people who in ways in which they can hear the connection. So, and you need to do that with any people group. The Jewish people are certainly no less.
So help us understand the Jewish people. can we generalize and say Jewish people, or are there various groups of Jewish people? Are there, is there a cultural Jew and a religious Jew, kind of like a...
Certainly a C&E Christian. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at most Jewish surveys, you know, the JCC here, well, it's not the JCC here, it's the Jewish Federation in St. Louis. They did a survey in 1995 of their own community, and 70% of Jewish people here in St. Louis didn't even believe in God. And so, and then the Pew Research, the Pew Research Center just did a survey nationally, so about 70% of Jewish people don't believe in God. That's a post-Holocaust reaction, I'm sure. And frankly, I'm not really, I don't really believe it. I think that it's something we sometimes like to say as Jews. But the reality is, there's, you know, I think in some sense you can generalize Jewish people, but in reality there are 16 different sects of Jews along a spectrum of the most absolute liberal to the secular humanist Jews to the most absolute Orthodox like the Lubavitchers. So, I think it's like anybody else. We can learn some generalizations. But ultimately, it's still one-on-one. You got to get to know the person.
Now, do Messianic Jews or Lutheran Jews fit into those 16 groups as well?
Jutherans, we call them. Yeah, Jutherans. They don't actually count, to be honest with you. Yeah. But certainly, you could add them. I think if the Jews were going to add us as part of their spectrum, which I don't honestly see that as not happening. There is a movement in the Reform that says it is terribly illogical to not consider Messianic Jews as Jews. Which I think, you know, on one hand, it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, it would give Messianic Jews more of a ingress into the Jewish community to share their faith. On the other hand, it might make them so comfortable that they wouldn't share their faith and could actually become sort of less, you know, I'm afraid it would water down some of their faith. So I think it's a double-edged sword. But on the whole, I think that's a movement that's happening in the Jewish community, but it hasn't happened yet. There are some proponents, predominantly in the Reform community, which is the it's still a conservative movement of Judaism when you look at some of the other ones, but it's probably the most liberal of the prominent three, which is Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox.
Now, 16 groups, 16 sects.
Yeah, two Jews, three opinions.
I think the Lutherans have you beat.
Oh, well, yeah, you never know.
At one point in time, it was like 27 just in North America alone, Lutheran bodies, and it's probably larger than that now.
Yeah.
So
it's very similar to that. Lutherans always ask me to characterize Jewish people, and the only thing I can ever come up with is you have Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, like we have ELCA, LCMS, and WELS. But you're right. There are Lutherans on both ends of that spectrum, just as there are Jews. So yeah, it's the way of humanity. We like to divide.
What role does tradition and family play in Jewish culture?
Well, the reality is where 70% of Jewish people typically don't believe in God, what the Holocaust has taught the Jewish community is whether or not we believe in God or not, that's not a big deal. But the one thing we do believe in is community. Because the reason the Holocaust even was allowed to happen is because, you know, largely secular humanist Jewish communities in the 19th and early 20th century, in Germany specifically, they considered themselves to be Germans, good patriotic Germans first, and that this would never happen to them. And of course, 300,000 Berliners died in the ovens. So the Jewish community post-Holocaust has pretty much said, we are Jews first and everything else second. We have to stick together if we're going to survive, and we will never forget. That's another mantra of the Jewish community. And in some sense, I understand that perspective. And so what that does is that elevates tradition, where most Jews don't go to synagogue anymore. Every Jew will celebrate Passover. Every Jew will, you know, and most Jews will go to synagogue during the High Holy Days, if nothing else, to keep Mama happy. But so the whole concept of community, tradition, passing this on to the next generation is really important. And of course, it's biblical. And if you look at the Passover narratives in Exodus, it's all about pass this on to your sons. You know, you will do this for all the generations to come. There's a reason why we remember these events. It's because in remembering them, we not only remember God's grace to us, but remember the strength of community. And so that is the sense that you get in a Jewish household. And so, you know, whereas Jews will, whether they believe in God or not, will likely belong to the synagogue or the temple because that's what you do. Mm-hmm. And you'll certainly belong to the JCC, and you'll give to the Jewish Federation, and you'll support Jewish causes. When I was in Colorado, I was a private investigator. I had about 80 lawyers who I worked with, and about 40 collection agencies and things like that. And 90% of them were Jews. I mean, Jews work with Jews, and we support, you know, our people. That's the way it goes. When I became a Christian and it got out, I started losing a lot of business and ended up having to sell my business to one of my employees and became a school teacher for $7,000 a year. We pay our school teachers really well here in our church. So that's the point. We stick together, and when one of you leaves the community, and Jews do think of Christians, Jewish Christians, as having deserted the community, they cast you out, and often you become estranged not only from family, but from community and from your past and tradition. And that's why it's so important for the church, when they come to faith, the church has to be community for those people. And should also be willing to affirm their traditions, because their traditions are our traditions. I mean, we don't have Christianity is a Jewish religion, let's face it. Just because it became predominantly, quote, Gentile-ish over time, its roots are in the Hebrew scriptures. Its roots are in Judaism, or at least Yahwism. Judaism is actually not as old as Christianity.
What's the Jewish word for Gentile-ish?
Goyisha. Yeah, so... And there's some other words that aren't so polite.
that we probably shouldn't say.
Yeah, right. You wouldn't understand them anyway. But, I mean, I'm always, the word shiksa and shegetz, which is the typical term that Jews will use for a non-Jew, male and female, or female and male, respectively, comes actually from the root abomination. So, So, you know, that's really... It's used rather lightly, but it actually means something quite horrible.
Now, you eventually ended up at seminary and studying at seminary to become an ordained minister in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And was it easy to go through the languages, Hebrew?
Hebrew was a snap. Greek with Dr. Veltz in summer boot camp was a challenge, but I survived. It was a good time.
Were all your friends, all your buddies in seminary, like coming to you to study in Hebrew?
I was actually...
Were you the star of the class?
I don't know if I was the star of the class. You'd have to ask Dr. Bartelt. But I I did do a lot of tutoring. Mm-hmm. And I made some money doing that too. So that was nice. And it was good. And I enjoyed that. And it was fun getting back into Hebrew. To be honest with you, I had been away from Hebrew for quite a number of years. But it... came back so because I started Hebrew school when I was 3. I knew how to read the scriptures well by the time I bar mitzvahed. And so once I got back into the Hebrew at the seminary, it was pretty much a snap. Yeah.
What can we, as Christians, what can we learn from Jewish community and traditions and family?
Well, I think one of the things, and you know, I was thinking about that as I was anticipating this show. To be honest with you, the whole business of passing on traditions to our children, and I'm always floored when kids are bored with the scriptures because there's, you know, so many, especially boys. I mean, there are so many awesome destruction stories that guys, you know, kids go and see Avengers. They just have to read the scriptures. But I'm not sure that we tell the stories well. One thing about being Jewish is we're a very storytelling culture. Mm-hmm. And when we tell the story, we embellish the story. my wife will always say, I exaggerate the stories. But you tell the stories, and the kids remember the stories, and then they tell their kids. And so, you know, in some sense, as a Christian community, one of the things that troubles me more than anything, and this is kind of my whipping boy, so forgive me if I get on a soapbox here. But coming from a Jewish community, I think because, of course, the constraints of, quote, the law, on the Sabbath, you tend to spend the whole day in community with one another. You can't go anywhere. You can't shop. You can't go to the movies. You can't mow the lawn. Basically, what you can do is eat the food you made the night before and argue about, you know, scripture and argue about other things. And so our Oneg Shabbat following the synagogue service was always lots of people hanging around, and so you get used to this. Then you come to faith in Jesus, you're kicked out of that community, you're part of a church community where you're taught the Holy Spirit draws us into fellowship with one another, and then you see that everybody leaves right after church and goes to mow the lawn or does their own thing and doesn't spend that time together. And there's a disconnect in the part of the Jewish believer. And I think in one sense, I understand, and there's all these, quote, cultural, and we have to respect the cultural roots that the LCMS grew out of. I do understand the Stoic Germanic kind of perspective that everybody wants to, but we're not really a German church anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Let's be honest. This is not, our great grandparents' German church anymore. And it shouldn't be. We should be open to all people. And so this whole concept of fellowship really needs to be worked on, because I think in some sense, and I don't want to make a law, that's not what we're trying to do, but why don't we enjoy spending more time together? And that is the issue that I think we have to really wrestle with. We spend our 50 minutes, and some of us, very small percentage, come to Bible study together.
Stick around for some coffee,
yeah,
maybe some donuts,
yeah,
or something.
Exactly, and a little chit-chat, and then we're out of there. And that's not what I think the fellowship of, if you look at Acts 2, 42 and following, the first church, they spent their lives together. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a casual acquaintance at church. And I think that's something that I think we probably should examine a little bit more in our churches.
Now, you called it Oneg Shabbat, is that right?
Yeah.
Now, was this something as a kid that you looked forward to as a child?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, there was a guy in our synagogue who always brought a bottle of Shivas and put it on the Oneg table. And I'd like to take a little tipple of that. So, but yeah, I mean, and it was extravagant, but it wasn't a big deal. It was, people would bring leftover Shabbat food from the night before to the Oneg Shabbat. But that was a great time. And the kids would run around, and the parents, and especially the men, the women were hen partying, the men were arguing about scripture or what the rabbi said. And the kids were all eating and playing games. And it was just...
See, that sounds Lutheran to me.
It should be. And certainly I've been to some Lutheran potlucks that are like that. And I tell you what, the most blessed, I don't want to characterize, I've been to a lot of churches, but I went to a Cubano refugee church and I actually had to preach in Spanish. And afterwards, they invited me to stay, and they all had this, and they did this every Sunday. They were a community of people who hung together. They were out in the parking lot. It's in Miami, so it's always nice. They had this, like, buffet of Cuban food out there that people all brought in. They were salsa dancing. I learned some moves that day that I'm just embarrassed about. But, it was just an awesome after-Sunday fellowship. And this is the kind of thing they did every Sunday, not just quarterly or, when we have Mission Sunday. And I think that's a real... it's a good model.
I know in my congregation, we have a picnic in the fall, a congregational picnic, and it's out at a beautiful park, and we all you know, we have a big barbecue,
sure.
and you know, everybody brings dessert. There's the dessert or the cakewalk, and mm-hmm. you know, games and stuff like that. But then we just spend time together, like you were talking about. And I say to myself every year, why do we only do this once a year?
Yeah.
This is beautiful. This is great.
Why are we so busy that we can't do that more regularly? And I know in our congregation they drive me nuts, and I hope they're not listening. But I mean, there was a time when we would stay together. We'd all bring food. We'd then go out to dinner. One night I didn't get home from Oneg Shabbat till like midnight because we all decided to go bowling together. But
that sounds fun.
It was fun. Every Sunday would be a challenge, but we do. We have people who will just come and sit and stay and eat and talk and enjoy each other's company till 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing. So
absolutely.
And obviously in planting the congregation, that was the mood I was really trying to, mm-hmm. to build there. And that's of anything that I've tried to do there, that's about the only thing that has stayed. But that's a good thing.
Well, we're talking about Jewish family traditions today with the Reverend Kevin Parviz, Rev Kevya from Congregation Kaiv Shalom and Burning Bush Ministries here in St. Louis. We've got more conversation coming up. We just have a short break. So stick around for more Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO right after this.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
The most dangerous place for a black baby to be in New York City isn't in a crack house or a violence-torn part of the city. The most dangerous place for a black baby in New York City is in the womb. The Big Apple aborts more black babies than those born alive. About half of all Latino babies conceived in New York are aborted. This matches our research of Planned Parenthood targeting minority neighborhoods for abortion. Nearly 80% of their surgical abortion mills are within walking distance of blacks and Latinos. This is consistent with the philosophy of Planned Parenthood's founder, Margaret Sanger, who called minorities human weeds. If you'd like to see the dramatic visual research, visit lifeissues.org and click on the microphone icon.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Is it enough for a Christian to believe that when they die, their spirit goes to be with Jesus? And what will the resurrection body be like? We'll find out Monday on Issues Etc. from Pastor James Douthwaite. We'll also continue our series, Top 3 Verses, with Pastor Brian Wolf Miller.
Issues Etc. live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
Join Worldwide KFUO and Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County for live Lenten worship on Wednesdays throughout the season of Lent. The broadcasts begin at 11 a.m. with Pastors Dennis Castens and Joe Ferguson presiding over midweek Lenten worship leading up to Easter Sunday. Peace Lutheran Church, located at 737 Barracks View Road in South County, invites you to join these Lenten worship services in person or on Worldwide KFUO at kfuo.org, the messenger of good news.
Who are KFUO Day sponsors? They're people like you. They're listeners who appreciate and support the Lord's work in broadcasting the good news of Jesus Christ every day. For more information on becoming a KFUO Day sponsor, contact Mary Schmidt at 314-996-1518 or Joni Harwell at 314-996-1512 or email us to find out more at gifts@kfuo.org.
Are you willing to share your talents while learning new skills and enjoying fellowship? The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is looking for volunteers who can help us share the love of Christ by offering their time and talents at the International Center. For more information, contact Maureen at Volunteer Connection 314-996-1629. 314-996-1629.
Worldwide KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Monday, March 7th, 2016. Today's day sponsors are Michael and Janine McGovern. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO in honor and loving memory of Theodore and Janice Floyd. Once again, we say thank you to Michael and Janine McGovern of St. Louis, Missouri. Today's Worldwide KFUO day sponsors.
Today's presentation is an encore presentation.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. We are having a good conversation, a good time here in studio with what did you call all this stuff? All the good stuff that we're snacking on today.
I said tchotchkes.
Yeah. Tchotchkes.
That's all the little things. You got a little menorah here. I think that's a menorah.
A seven-branch lampstand.
And we have our candle, which we haven't lit, but that's okay.
Oh, here, I can. It's not a real candle.
Oh, good. So you turn it on. Is that what you do? Yeah. You get an ambiance from that.
It's real fancy.
Oh, that's nice.
There we go.
And we're having our bread and our wine. So.
Yeah, all the tchotchkes here. So recently, you celebrated a Seder here in the St. Louis area with your congregation and Burning Bush Ministries, and a pretty big event. It drew quite a crowd, didn't it?
Yeah, we had 124 in a room that seats comfortably 80. So that was really nice. But actually, we were praying that God would multiply the space, and he did. I'm not sure where it came from, but the walls expanded, and we got 124 in there, and it was really a blessing over at St. Paul de Pere. And it was a great event, yeah.
What? And that's a pretty regular family tradition, community tradition in Jewish community, the Seder.
Sure.
What's the history behind that? Exodus, right?
Well, yeah, obviously it's the Exodus. Telling of the deliverance of God's people from bondage in Egypt. It's a great foretelling of the deliverance of God's people from bondage to sin. Mm. There's such great allusions to Jesus. And of course, you have, as I finish the Seder up, you know, Moses brought us from bondage in Egypt through the waters of the Red Sea into the wilderness, and God provided for our needs. And in exactly the same way, but in a greater way, Jesus brings us out of bondage through our waters of baptism into the wilderness, which is what we call life, and provides for our needs. And then, you know, the promise is you're going to go to the promised land. That's our promise. The promised land is that heavenly banquet that Jesus is waiting to have the fourth cup of wine of the Seder with us at.
Ah, now you bring up one of the aspects of the Seder, the cups.
Yeah.
What are you said the fourth cup. What are the four cups in the Seder?
There's four cups during the Seder. Each cup is named for a promise that God gave to Moses when he brought the people out of Egypt. The first cup is the cup of blessing. The second is the cup of praises and plagues. The third cup is the cup of redemption, and that's the one that Paul specifically refers to, that Jesus took the third cup after supper. Because what's weird, what Christians don't get is during the Passover Seder, there is a festive meal or a supper in the midst of the Seder. It falls in the middle of the Seder. So you have liturgy on both sides of dinner. And the third cup is what comes right after dinner, and that's the cup of redemption. And then the fourth cup is called the cup of sanctification. And I'm convinced in my study, and I've had scholars at my Passover Seders and some of the best scholars of this generation, I'm convinced that, and they've agreed with me, that when Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine again with you until I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom," that's that fourth cup. And so our tradition, though in Jewish families, everybody will have the four cups of wine, we always wait on the fourth cup because that's the cup that Jesus has waiting for us at the heavenly banquet.
Aha. Uh-huh. Very interesting. I've been to a few Seders in the past, and I've never heard that perspective, so...
Yeah, maybe, I don't know if that's original to me or not, but if it isn't, I'll steal it. But I do think that, you know, clearly there is the Exodus passages, but there are, I mean, there's Luke and there's Matthew specifically. There's Paul who makes references to the Passover. And there's clearly a Haggadah in the New Testament that tells you what's going on at the Passover Seder. Now, granted, the Bible is a series of images, not a motion picture. Mm-hmm. So we have snapshots of them, but we can fill those snapshots in with the traditional Passover liturgy, which, you know, goes back to at least, I mean, we have Midrashic references to the liturgy to 200 years before Jesus.
All right, now and you're using all these terms. You're going to have to explain
the,
it for
you know,
me.
The rabbinic commentary, sort of the oral tradition that there is in Judaism. And the oral tradition, it's in and of itself, is this whole business of father passing on to his son what needs to be known and the remembrance of these things. That's how the scriptures got transmitted to us and finally were written down. And so we really love to explore that oral tradition.
Do you like the fact that I have to turn down my mic every time I chew?
Oh, I'm just not chewing. I'm going to use my cough button here.
And, so that I don't crunch in the audience's ears. No.
Slurp.
We talked about the cups, the four cups in the Seder. And some of the Seders I've attended include the full meal. And you said that you've got a meal and a celebration or a festival in the middle of this liturgy.
And what the Passover Seder is it's, of course, they're telling of the story of God's redemption of his people from bondage in Egypt. So you got all the stories. And so you have all these ceremonial foods. Some of the things you didn't bring in, for example, horseradish,
the bitter herbs,
charosis, the mortar.
That's the good stuff.
The good stuff, yeah. And, you know, of course, the parsley, which we love to eat first and then smile at each other. you know, the parsley is the hyssop that was dipped in the basin of blood. And painted on the doorposts of the... And I always make this connection to what hyssop is, because it's interesting if you look at hyssop with the parsley, you got the hyssop that Moses used to paint the doorposts of the homes. Mm-hmm. You have hyssop that David cried out to be cleansed with. And it was hyssop that was dipped into wine vinegar and raised up to Yeshua while he was on the cross. And so, you know, even the choice of plant in Moses' time was a foretelling of what would happen. Because as Moses raised blood up to paint the doorposts of his home, the soldiers raised wine up to Yeshua's lips on a wooden cross. And it's just a wonderful picture of a foretelling of Jesus and the fulfillment. Everything about, and I will go on record as saying this, everything about every Jewish festival is fulfilled in Jesus, and is so clearly fulfilled in Jesus. I think that God, even though, and I don't, you know, I kind of get this, and I don't think we have time to go into it, but Paul says that God has hardened the Jewish heart in part for a time until the fullness of Gentiles comes in. But even with that hardness of heart, God has put the truth of his Savior Jesus in all the traditions of the Jewish people. And so if you get to know those traditions and you're sharing your faith with somebody who's Jewish and they're even remotely open to it, now I will grant you, not many Jewish people are even open to the conversation. It takes a long time and a good friendship to be able to get there. But once you do, these things become so very clear. And then you only have a choice as a Jew. I mean, we can choose to reject God. There's no question about it. But you can choose to reject God against amazing prophetic foretelling. That's truly a choice of rejection that is that's hard to do.
So you really have a tough job before you then.
I mean, no more than I think anybody else in this day and age, but certainly you know, the spiritual hardening that is there, it makes, I think, Jewish ministry probably the most difficult of the ethnic groups that there are, the gods. And the thing that really kills me, though, is that we have a long history of proclaiming the gospel to people groups, but not so much to the Jewish people. Now, you know, our certainly ministry to the Jewish people in the LCMS goes back to the 1880s. But there's a big gap between 1893 and 1973, which is how long the gap was, basically, for the LC-MS. But the Jewish people are the only ethnic group that God specifically says to go and witness to. Everybody else falls into the nations. So, I think it's kind of ironic that it's the one that we have the most trouble with having to deal with.
You mentioned earlier how the hyssop points in the hyssop or the parsley in the meal points to Jesus. So everything in these traditions points to Yeshua. The other aspects of the Seder that point to Yeshua, we talked about the parsley, bitter herbs.
Well, I mean, the bitter herbs is the bitterness of bondage. And of course it leads to the bitterness of the bondage of sin and the bitterness of the bitter cup. I mean, it was bitter wine that was lifted up to Jesus. And it was a bitterness, certainly as we celebrate the Passion this week, we all have kind of struggled with the kind of oxymoronic Good Friday thing. It's bad for him, but good for us.
Right. How can you call it good?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. It's really hard. And you go to those services and they're just, you know, stricken, smitten, and afflicted. What an anguish-filled hymn that is. How can this be good? And yet it is, because out of bitterness God brings, just like he does in the bitter herbs. Hillel was a great rabbi who he taught that he created something called the Hillel sandwich that we eat for Passover. And basically it's a piece of matzah with both horseradish and charoseth on it.
Oh yeah, that's good.
And it's really good. I mean, it makes the horseradish palatable and it spices up the charoseth. And charoseth, I hadn't mentioned it, but it's apples, nuts, wine, and cinnamon. And Hillel
says,
that's
why it's good. I didn't know all the secret ingredients.
That's why it's in it. But, people would ask Hillel, why do we use something so sweet to represent something so bitter? And his point is always, while life is both bitter and sweet, with the promise of God's redemption, it is always sweet. And so and the promise of God's redemption is Jesus. And yes, I mean, we can celebrate now, even reclining. There's these little odd references in the scriptures to Jesus reclining at table with the 12. And I think people tend to just read over those and not give much thought as to what they were doing. Everybody just lays around in the Old Testament, in the Bible times. But reclining was an intentional practice, because the first Passover was eaten in haste. You couldn't stand around. You had your cloak around your shoulders, your belt around your waist, your staff in your hand, sandals on your feet, ready to get out of there. So now we recline leisurely, knowing that we are free. But we have to recognize that life is still bitter and sweet, and we still have a promise of redemption. And unfortunately, while we have celebrated that redemption that is Jesus, the Jewish people continue to suffer in not just, persecution and the kind of persecution complex that rightly probably the Jewish people have, but the reality that go to a Jewish funeral and it's just no hope whatsoever. And there is a hope, and the hope is in the Hillel sandwich, and the hope is the redemption that we have from Jesus. So there's all those connections we have. We have matzah. I mean, matzah is, Jesus says, take and eat, this is my body. And I always point out how literal he's being, because matzah traditionally can only be cooked for 18 minutes, which is the numerical equivalent of the word chai, which means life. It is thin and pierced because of the heat that rises through it to cook it. So it has a bunch of little holes. It has a bunch of little stripes. How can we not get Isaiah 53 out of that? He was pierced and beaten and striped for our iniquities. And yet there's life in that. It's baked for 18 minutes. It's full of life. The Afikoman is all about Jesus, broken in half, wrapped in linen, removed. I mean, the matzah touch that most Jews don't even get is a tradition in their families. It's a single linen with three different compartments in it. One has each slice of the matzah in there, and the middle slice is the one that's taken out, broken, wrapped in linen, hidden away. Mm-hmm. And when the child finds the Afikoman, he gets a gift on Shavuot, which is usually his first Hebrew scriptures, because Shavuot is the festival of God giving Torah to Moses. But what is Shavuot? But Pentecost, where we receive the word on our heart. And everything about Passover is a perfect prophetic fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy of the new covenant. And it's just incredible. I'm always amazed every year at this time of year when I go through a Seder, I say to myself, how did I never get this? And I still say to myself, how do they never get this? But nobody's around to tell them. And that's the other thing that's so important about Passover. When the children of Israel were redeemed from Egypt, they were brought out of Egypt with sojourners among them, which were foreigners. The Egyptians came out of Egypt with them. And so it's tradition for every year at Passover for a Jewish family who's having their Seder to invite a goy to eat their meal with them, to be the sojourner among them. So if you're one of those who's invited,
learn about it.
Learn about it. And then find ways lovingly to say, you know what this reminds me of? Because the third cup, every Jewish family does this. They take the afikoman after the kid finds it. They break it up into pieces. They give everybody a piece. And it's that piece of afikoman along with the third cup of wine, the cup of redemption, that is a picture of our redemption. That's what Jesus was doing when he instituted the Lord's Supper. And what an amazing picture of what we can share. And you know, Jesus said, whenever you do this in remembrance of me. I don't think he's necessarily talking about the Lord's Supper. He's saying, whenever you do any of the things that you do, like Shabbat on Friday night, and you say the blessings over bread and wine, or Passover when you're doing this, everything that you do, do in remembrance of me. Even your Purim parties, do in remembrance of me. I mean, everything is in remembrance of Jesus, and it changes the complexion of what our festivals are like. And I think it adds great meaning to our Christian life as well.
Just hearing you talk about this is just, my brain is just is spinning with, wow, we kind of miss out on community, as you were talking about earlier, this sense of community that we get from sharing these together. I could imagine as coming in as the sojourner, the foreigner in a Jewish family's Seder, by the third time I said Yeshua, they'd probably kick me out.
Yeah, they wouldn't. you're their guest. You know, obviously be winsome, be, you know, loving about it, but also be bold. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the criticisms of having Passover Seders is that we don't want to insult. Well, you know, Christ is supposed to be a stumbling block for the Jews. I mean, if we don't, and what does Paul say? But we are to make the Jewish people jealous for the faith that we have. They're not very jealous about our faith. We need to find ways to show them exactly how much God has poured out his love upon them and us in his son Jesus. And he's for them as much as he is for us.
Amen.
Yeah.
So is it appropriate, is it offensive to say from crackers to Christ? Because this is kind of like this bread is kind of like a cracker, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a giant saltine.
Without the
not
salt.
Too salty, yeah. But I think however you want to do it, I think that's, I wouldn't say that was inappropriate. I mean, my new Passover ritual is to watch hilarious Passover videos on YouTube. And, you know, Jews making a whole lot more fun of Passover than I ever would. So.
What's the funniest one?
Oh,
so
there's
far.
A great one called Jumungus. And I actually tweeted it out because it's just so funny. It's called, of course, They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. And that's the motto of every Jewish festival. So. But it's pretty funny, and if you look up on YouTube or look at my Twitter feed, you can find it. It's pretty funny.
I love the little music video, the video on the congregation's page.
The
23 seconds that'll change your life.
That's right. Yeah, I'm glad you saw that. I think that's pretty funny.
I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah, I could just see Luther going, "All right, I'm putting up with this stuff."
So we've talked about the bitter herbs, the matzah, the afikoman, things like that. Anything else from the Seder? We've got just a couple more minutes, a few more minutes to point out those or other Jewish family traditions.
The obvious thing for the Seder is the other thing that we haven't really talked about is the Elijah's cup.
Ah.
You know, there's always a place set for Elijah. And Elijah is, according to Jewish tradition, going to come at Passover and announce the coming of Messiah. And so we have this Elijah's cup, and we have a place set for him. We leave the door ajar. And when you're a kid, you get really excited because you really want Messiah to come. So you're looking out into the darkness to see if Elijah's coming or anything like that. I can remember my imagination running away with me and thinking that the wine was actually going down in his cup, things like that. And you know, I think most Jewish people will make, you know, that's just a tradition. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, most Jewish people today aren't really even expecting Messiah to come anymore. Mm-hmm. They do this.
He's forgotten us?
I just think that, you know, it's become a messianic age, or, you know, we don't really, you know, if you don't believe in God, how can you believe in Messiah? Mm-hmm. It's just, this is all just tradition. But, you know, Jesus talks about Messiah, about Elijah having come already in the form of John the Baptist. And when we think of what John the Baptist called out the first time he saw Jesus while he's standing there on the banks of the Jordan River, what does he call him? Behold, the mm-hmm. Lamb of God. That's Passover. That's a Passover analogy. Here's the Lamb of God who's taking away the sin of the world. That whole lamb, the lamb shank, the egg, all of that stuff that we don't have anymore in the Seder, is all about Jesus. And Elijah is all, you know, that Elijah's cup all points to Jesus if we know how to do it. I wrote a Bible study called Bible Feast. It's a lifelight. And it's at CPH. You can find it there in their catalog. And it kind of talks in a shorter way about all this stuff if you have any interest. Or you could look at our Haggadah on our website. It also talks about a lot of these things.
I'm glad you pronounced it because I've mispronounced that probably for about 15, 20 years now.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Haggadah.
Haggadah, yeah.
I always put the syllable on
Haggadah,
the wrong.
Haggadah, yeah. That's a common thing. But
Haggadah.
Haggadah.
Well, Seder, a great picture that points to a Greek tradition that points to Yeshua. Any other traditions just briefly that point
well,
to
Yeshua?
Well, I
mean, just my favorite, one of the other festivals that we always have a party at is Purim. Mm-hmm. And Purim, of course, is the melodramatic reading of the text of the book of Esther. And Esther, interestingly enough, is the only book of the Bible that God's name is not mentioned in. And yet I always point out that God is all over the book of Esther. And one of the best messianic fulfillment prophecies is Mordechai saying to his niece Esther, who knows that for some other, you know, for this purpose you weren't brought here. He says, if you don't do this, salvation will come to us from another place. We're confident of that, but right now your people are suffering and you're in this place to do it. And it's in chapter 4, and I've got a Esther scroll that was in 1580, it was penned, and right about coterminous with the Book of Concord. In fact, it was at the CHI for a while when they were opening their new museum. It's just a great family celebration. Hanukkah's everything about Hanukkah points to Jesus, the menorah, the whole story of the Hanukkah, the dreidel. I mean, everything about being Jewish points to Jesus. Believing in Jesus is the most Jewish thing you can do. And yet it's just because of the history of the church and the Jews, you know, men in the name of God have really besmirched the message a lot over the centuries. So we've got, you know, and understandably, we've got some work to do. But it's just celebrate those, you know, get to know those festivals, go to them with your friends. I had a lady call who said, you know, I've been invited to a Passover Seder. Should I go? Absolutely. But when you go, be bold, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This year in St. Louis?
Next year in Jerusalem. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Yeah.
Today we've been talking with Reverend Rev Kevya from Congregation Kai Shalom here in St. Louis and Burning Bush Ministries. Pastor Parviz, thanks so much for being
Thank
our guest
you.
Today
it's
on Faith and Family. It's been a good conversation. I've enjoyed the talk and celebrating a little bit with some of these tchotchkes here.
That's right. All right. Thank you.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.